Hey everyone, I'm Will Richardson, and I want to welcome you back to Season 1 of the 2017 Modern Learners Podcast, where this year we're scouring the world for schools and districts that are raising the bar when it comes to thinking about relevant, sustainable change for their students. In this episode, I interview Pam Moran, who is the superintendent of the Albemarle, Virginia School District, where more than almost any other school district that we've seen, the culture is moving away from teaching toward learning and away from consuming to making. Pam is an outspoken advocate for change that goes beyond labels and technology, and in this interview, we discuss a wide range of topics, including what a Twitter culture means, making yes the default answer, and how to get kids to stop burning their learning once they graduate. Pam's challenging yet optimistic vision is inspiring others to reimagine their schools and their districts, and I'm guessing you'll be inspired as well. And remember, if you want to learn more about this podcast series, about our white papers, our masterclasses, and about our new 8-week course on modern leadership that we're launching in March, check out our private Modern Learners Facebook group, or head on over to modernlearners.com where you can sign up for our amazingly informative weekly newsletter that tracks all the opportunities and challenges of learning today. But for now, sit back and enjoy my conversation with Pam Moran. So I just want to start with the question that I'm asking everyone in this series, and that is, what is the question that is driving you and the work that you're doing right now?
Well, I think that for me, Will, and I when I read that, I thought that's a really interesting question to ask. At some level, I think that I've really worked on almost a lifelong question of what causes people when they enter a career such as education to continue to evolve and change the way that they think about things, the questions that they ask, the practices in which they engage, the belief systems that they have. How do people make decisions about what they hold dear? How do they consider new ways of thinking that potentially might cause them to actually evolve what it is that they think about and what they do to act on what they think about? And that may seem really esoteric, but it emerged for me, and probably fairly early in my career, from that standpoint of being around educators who are very vibrant thinkers, who continue to ask themselves questions in regards to the successes that they and failures that they have in the work that they do, and seeing some people truly continue to ask that question across their career and to grow and evolve as learners themselves, and people that seem to get stuck. And one of the questions that I've had is, why do some people get stuck, and why do some people continue to evolve?
How's it gone in terms of getting an answer to those questions?
Well, you know, it's really fascinating because I ended up in 1995 using that question when I did my dissertation as a qualitative study. And I went out and did sort of a triangulated look at who were teachers that at least from three different sources, very different, diverse sources, people said, here's an educator who has continued to grow and evolve across their career. And then when I got that pool of people, I went and just did sort of almost an emergent design qualitative study. And it was really fascinating because, you know, then obviously one of the things that I tried to look for was, are there themes across those people? And there were some themes. One of them that probably was the dominant piece that really emerged for me as I dug in on that group of educators that represented people who continued to change is that they sustained a real sense of efficacy across their careers. They really believed that they made a difference. And when they ran into barriers or hurdles, they constantly turned the question back on themselves, of almost from a Bill Glasser focus of, what do I need to do to help children be successful, to help this particular learner be successful? What do I need to change? Versus looking at the kid as being the source of the problem, they tended to look at themselves through that efficacy lens in terms of, I can make a difference, but I'm not making a difference right here, so what do I need to do? The other thing that I found that was really key across those groups is that those teachers had relationships with other teachers who believed that they also made a difference and were constantly in a quest to figure out, how do I get continually better at helping kids really realize successes in the work that we're trying to accomplish together? And so it really struck me that every one of those people also had critical friends in their lives, and they valued that those friends would challenge them in terms of their own sense of what's going on here, but also really help them think through, how do I really negotiate a pathway to helping children find that sense of self as learner, and to really see themselves as people who had real control over the learning environment, from the standpoint of not putting that expectation on others to own it, but putting that expectation on themselves.
So it sounds like, it sounds like culture, right? And one of the things that's really struck me just in a lot of the visits that I make to different schools is that there seems to be a culture of powerlessness, almost, that as much as teachers may be frustrated by, you know, certain requirements or standards or whatever else, they don't feel like they're empowered to make the changes that they want to make. And when I listen to you, it sounds like the teachers that you're talking about not only had a culture where they could make change and they were almost expected to make change, but they also had the support from other people within that culture to do that. Would that be accurate? Or
I think so. And I would even describe some of these people who shared their experiences across careers, because all of these teachers, I really looked for people who had at least 15 years of experience in the classroom or in the teaching space that they were in at the time. And, you know, one of the things that's really fascinating to me is that even if they had been in a place where they had not felt that sense of supportive community around them, they made it for themselves. And so there was that sort of a self drive in terms of sense of power of, I can control this. And so, you know, I think about that oftentimes that our teachers who have that sense of powerfulness as and confidence as teacher educators are constantly asking questions about what the bureaucracy or the corporate world throws at them as being, this is what works, this is what you need to use, that sort of lockstep approach that we really put in place after a nation at risk. And so these are teachers who have a great sense of confidence. As a superintendent, one of the things that I've really tried to do is to take that big question that I've had for my whole career of, what is it that causes educators to continue to grow, develop, and evolve who they are in terms of their own confidence, their own sense of power as people who can ask really great questions themselves, who are incredibly creative individuals. I say that you can't find a greater space of creativity than in education. You just don't see it sometimes because teachers hide it. You know, how is it that you make that part of the formal culture? You know, and so, you know, one of the things that I think about is, you know, that if you look at the people that I would describe as some of the really great researchers and writers and thinkers that have influenced me, going back to, you know, Dewey and looking at people like Roland Barthes, if you look at Mike Rose, if you look at, you know, a variety of people, Saracen is one, even Cuban and Tyack, those guys all tended to focus much more on the culture of school than they did on the procedures and, you know, the whole sort of reform effort model. And so for me, that's been a really important part of what I see as being the essence of what we do, is to try to build really healthy cultures. I think it was Barth that talked about what are the non-discussables, that the more things that you have in a school environment that are off limits for discussion, the more unhealthy the culture is. And so one of the things that I think about is that when you open the door and say nothing is off the table, anything can be discussed, people can put anything on the table, you can, you know, there, the hierarchy, the more flat it is, you know, one of the things that can make me crazy at times as a result of really building a culture where, you know, anything's on the table and anybody can talk to anybody about those things, is that, you know, I have teachers that, you know, talk to board members. I have board members that feel very confident and comfortable walking into our schools. And I never really know exactly what's going to get said or who's going to talk to who. And so, you know, when you have that, some, you know, and I think probably that all of us, you know, who become superintendents have at times an urge to try to control the conversation.
Sure. Yeah.
But when you let that go and you fight that urge to control the conversation, then you never know who's talking to who or about what. And I think it was one of the things that was really interesting for me with Twitter was Paula White, who I think you know, who's on Twitter, introduced me to Twitter in 2008-09. And she said, you know, Pam, this is something you should really know about because you actually have employees in the school district who are talking to people all over the world. And I thought, oh, let me check this out. And one of the things that I wrote about this at a later date, that one of the things that really challenged me is that when you are at the top of the food chain in a school system as a superintendent, you know, in the old style hierarchy, you really controlled who got access to staff and whose staff accessed. So you had control over what conferences people went to. You controlled what professional development people did. You controlled who came into the system to work with teachers. And all of a sudden, social media took down the barriers, took down the walls of schools, of school districts. And you can have somebody in Albemarle County talking to someone in Australia or California or to Will Richardson, and bringing things back into the system that, you know, really was kind of the Wild West. And one of the first urges I had was, I really want to get on so that I can make sure I know exactly what's going on. Well, eventually, you know, when you have, you know, not just 10 or 20, but hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of, you know, we've got 1,200 teachers, and I think we probably have at least 50% or more of our staff that are in Twitter, you know, beyond other social media platforms. You don't have control over that anymore. And all of a sudden, you know, what you've got is this community that has grown from being just a grade level or a department or a school or a school district. You now have a community of learners and people who are corresponding and connecting and sharing resources and asking questions and learning about different practices that extends, you know, globally.
So I just want to ask you, because I know that as I've kind of tracked your work and tracked what's been going on in Albemarle, in large measure because of Twitter and because of how transparent a lot of your teachers are and your willingness to retweet all the things that your teachers are putting up there, I'm curious as to how that work informs and helps your vision evolve. I mean, you know, when you talk about teachers who are willing to keep changing and keep questioning, you know, that can go two ways, right? That can go toward a more progressive vision, or it could go more toward a more standardized vision, depending on what the culture kind of offers up and what the conversations are that are going on. So I'm curious, because it feels like in a lot of districts too, the conversation kind of gets stuck and it doesn't really embrace a lot of those changes that you just talked about. So how do you nurture those different conversations in your district to then evolve the vision, and how, you know, how kind of focused or how concrete is that process? Or is it more just kind of this general evolution that happens because of the transparency. I don't know if that question makes sense, but I think you know what I'm getting at.
And you know, it's really interesting because, you know, one of the things that I think about is that, you know, an organization, a school division, a school district is a system. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, Russell Acuff and Deming.
One of my favorites. Yep.
Yeah, those guys, you know, had a pretty intense conversation in 1992 or 93 about education. And one of the things that I always found really interesting is the idea that, you know, that Deming really talked about how the system really can't understand itself. I thought that was a fascinating way of thinking about, you know, and I think the other thing that I really took away from him is that, you know, that you can't manage any organization, corporation or public or private by visible numbers alone. And I think that's been one of the things that we've tried to do is that the whole reform effort has been based on trying to manage a system that really always struggles to understand itself by using numbers alone, by
right.
turning everything into Excel spreadsheets and data charts. But what I really think is that, you know, and it's interesting because, you know, I know that you have this kind of yin and yang, as I think a lot of us do, around the encroaching technology into our world and the face-to-face opportunity for learning to occur. And it struck me a couple, 3 years ago when I was talking to some high school kids, and we were talking about sort of the future of learning. And the kids really made it very clear to me as a superintendent from their perspective. And these were high school kids circa 2000 and probably 13. And one of the things that they really went after is that what was really important to them was having a social learning community in which they've spent time with their peers and with adults, teachers, et cetera, in schools. And they had no interest in just moving into a world where everything was just virtual, despite the fact that there are a lot of adults who either think that's what kids want or think that's what kids need. I think that our educators, that for me, what makes the system run is creating as many opportunities in as many different paths as possible for people to talk to each other. That it is only through conversation and through interaction, through engagement, that we are able to appreciate an inquiry process for making the kinds of things that cause us to go after what's really important from my perspective of what it is that we leave kids when they leave us as
right.
as learners when they graduate. And, you know, it was fascinating because, you know, I think it was maybe Barth who talked about something I read one time about that he watched a group of kids after high school graduation burning their books. And when he talked to them, he was really shocked to find out that these were not kids that had really struggled in school, but these were kids that were actually pretty good students, all going off to college. And he said, if what we do is to create an environment where when kids graduate, that they celebrate by burning their learning, what is it that we've really done to the learning process? And he said, you know, learning should not be something where kids get hurt by it, but we create so many systems inside our schools in which kids, that we make the case that we're going to hurt you in order for you to learn, whether it's through grades, whether it's through, you know, a variety of things that we do that set up sort of a punishment reward system. But it strikes me that what we really want, and that's where I think that as a system, we have set out very clearly that we want kids that when they graduate, that they take with them at least some of the basics of competencies that we associate with people who are lifelong learning committed people. And that if we educate kids so that when they graduate, that they go out and continue to love learning, to be curious learners, to want to continue to evolve and develop themselves as learners, then we've done our job, because the kids aren't going to burn their learning. They're going to take it with them, and they're going to see it as something that they value and hold dear. What I think is that inside our system, I've really tried to work, and I don't want to paint the picture that everything is always rosy inside Albemarle, because, you know, we're constantly, you know, growing and developing and evolving, and, you know, we're pretty WYSIWYG. What you see is what you get, and, you know, we've got people that are far along a continuum of seeing that lifelong learning as being critical, and we have people that struggle with that somewhat and are pretty, you know, still held in a sense of that sort of one foot on the side of the stream of tradition and trying to make that leap over the stream to a more contemporary way of thinking about learning and learners. But for me, it's about the interaction. It's about engagement. It's about setting up a situation where people define themselves as learners, whether you're a teacher with 40 years of experience, or a teacher who's a first-year teacher, a bus driver, a teaching assistant, a kindergartner, a principal, a superintendent, that staying open to new knowledge, to new questions, to new ways of thinking about what we do to help kids graduate so that they aren't burning their learning, right, but taking it with them is really key for me. And we do have processes that we put in place. I mean, you know, we have what we call professional learning communities. And, you know, we went through sort of the DeFore, genre of that back in the, 2003, 2004. We've really tried to evolve that to have it be much more about robust conversation than simply a data set.
Right.
Really try to encourage our teachers and our administrators and anybody else that's out there in our community to engage in seeing themselves as a leader of learning, bringing ideas to us, asking questions, getting out into the bigger world of social media and seeing what else is out there. You know, one of the things that Becky Fisher pretty early on said is, how do we give, you know, people credit for participating in, you know, chats online, or, you know, being, you know, following blog posts and doing things that are kind of alternatives to traditional professional development. We've put in instructional coaching models that hopefully make sure that every teacher, as they come into our system, has a go-to person that can be a critical friend, not a part of any evaluation system, outside of administration totally, but just simply there to say, what is it that you are interested in? What are your struggles? What are your challenges? What are the things that you really want to pursue? What can we do to help you go through a process in which we can, you know, support that up inside the classroom, not sitting in just traditional professional development?
One thing that strikes me just in just listening to you now and thinking about, again, what I know about Albemarle and what I've seen about Albemarle, you know, you mentioned earlier how difficult it is for the system to understand itself. And I think, you know, you look at the things that you share online and you get a better understanding of what's happening in that system. And in that way, I think social media has probably been a great affordance for creating culture, creating a vision that everyone can see. It's more tangible. It's more easily shared, you know. And in so many schools, you walk in and people don't know what's happening two doors down. They have no idea what types of activities kids or what kids are doing, what types of learning teachers are doing, the questions that they're asking. And yet I see so many opportunities for the people in your district, whether they're on board with that or not. At least they see some of the things that are happening. And
it does create an image. Right. You know, and one of the things that we know is that...
And an expectation, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, and so, you know, and you've probably, I sent you that thing on the thing I did about getting to yes.
I love that. Yeah, just, you know, I mean, and just briefly, just tell that story, because it's
oh, yeah,
I think it's a perfect example, though, Pam, of a leader in a district who is willing to say yes to something that you don't know really what the answer is going to be, right? So what the outcome is going to be. So just,
you know,
just briefly tell that story, because it's so good.
Yeah, and it's you know, so I had a middle school principal who had some kids that wanted to, quote, you know, sort of that whole design thinking thing. They wanted to redesign the cafeteria in their school to have a better dining experience. And, you know, and so, you know, I said, yeah, I think that's a great idea. And, you know, and they went and solicited some grant funding and were able to bring Alex Gilliam, a public workshop, down to work with them. And of course, you know, I've got this mindset of when I think about redesigning anything, because, you know, I'm a baby boomer, I think, well, you know, maybe they're going to put some booths in there,
couches,
and, you know, some couches, maybe put some new, you know, some sports posters up, bring some plants in. And then, you know, I start looking at, you know, Alex is down there working. And of course, Iris Sokol is kind of overseeing it. And, you know, and you always have to be careful, because, you know, when Iris involved, he is definitely going to push the envelope in terms of what's out there. And I start seeing images going up on Instagram and Twitter. And I'm going, what in the world are these kids doing? You know, building tree houses. And I called
on
down.
Wheels, right?
Yeah.
Tree houses on wheels. Yeah. I love it.
I called down there. I said, what are you guys doing? And, you know, and the answer I get, you know, on the other end of the line from the principal and from Ira is, well, the kids actually, they decided they didn't want to build dining room booths. They wanted to build tree houses, rolling tree houses. And I said, well, how tall are these things? You know, and I'm thinking, okay, I need to say yes, because that's part of my mantra is, how do you always say yes to great ideas? You know, I had a mentor teacher that to me early on. He said, bam, if you tell a teacher no when they come to you and they've got an idea, they want to do something, if you say no, they'll never come back to you. And they're going to tell a whole bunch of other people,
right,
don't bother, because she'll just say no. So I said, well, okay, so these are going to be maybe like 8 feet tall. And Iris says, well, more like 12 or 14. And I'm like, oh my gosh. So, you know, I grab somebody and I say, I want to come down and see. So I get down there and, you know, you can hear like the power saws and stuff down in the cafeteria. You get down there and these kids are all buzz and working, and there's teachers with them. You know, and this is like 2 weeks before state testing, Will. And, you know, and I'm sitting there and I'm you know, looking at this. And the principal says to me, said, Pam, you know, if you look at this, she said, it's really amazing to me, because there are kids up there who are some of, and this is an at-risk middle school, she said, some kids that are real challenges for us, and they are some of the most, you know, focused, leading kids right now in this experience that, you know, I've never seen them like this. And math teacher says, my gosh, these kids are doing math I never thought they'd be able to do. I mean, they're having to, you know, do all kinds of measurements and geometry and you know, just it's pretty fascinating watching this whole thing go on. And Alex is kind of masterminding it.
It's great.
And I just step away and go, how could I say no to this? How could I stop this?
You know, it's really interesting in the blog post. I love the way you wrote it, though, because in the blog post, you say, I work as a superintendent in a school district that is learning to get to yes, right? And
absolutely.
So what that suggests to me, and again, what I see in a lot of places, is that the kind of default answer is no. And it may not be like abjectly no, but it's more like, well, yeah, but, you know, you can maybe do this, but so it's interesting. Yeah,
this was a real put your money where your mouth is.
Yeah, absolutely.
Moment for me, because, you know, I mean, I've said yes to all kinds of things, you know, yes to field trips, yes to activities, yes to, you know, changing things all over the system. But this one was, and I looked at it and I thought, well, one of the things I'm going to have to do is check with my lawyer, because I am a superintendent. I don't have to think about these things. But I have a great school board lawyer. And when I talked to him, he said, Pam, get the thing inspected so that it meets whatever the criteria is. Make sure that the school has very specific plans for, you know, how this is going to get used. And he says, go forward with it. This is something that, yeah, you can make this work.
But why do you think that we have to learn to get to yes in schools?
Because I think that bureaucracies are traditionally set up to say no. And schools are set up to sustain the traditions that have been in place going back to 19, whatever it was, 10, when Cubberly, put scientific management in and changed the whole way that, you know, that learning occurs. I think that we are set up to basically filter out anything that challenges the norm of 1910.
So how do you change that? I mean, it's easy to say yes to the little things, right? But to the big things like that, it gets really hard. So if you're giving advice to someone who is in a culture of no, right, then how do you begin to change that? And what are the, I guess, personal characteristics that you have to have in order to lead that effort? How do we learn that?
Well, you got to certainly have the willingness to, and I wouldn't describe myself as being, this like flamboyant risk taker who jumps out of airplanes. But I think you have to be willing to walk up to a cliff and leap. You know, Kierkegaard calls it that great leap of faith, where you sometimes walk up to the edge of something and the other side is unknowable, and you have to be able to make a jump. And I think that part of that is you have to be able as a leader to make yourself take that leap and not be fearful that the other side is necessarily going to be something that's a negative.
More catastrophic.
I think you build that over time by taking small steps. So when I'm out, one of the things that I say to people, and I kind of laugh because I was down doing a thing and started trying to think about how do you really talk to people about that process of getting to yes. And one of the things that I realized is that saying yes is the easy part. Acting on yes is the hard part. And the acting on yes for me is about the culture. And here's what I mean by that. That if I have a person who comes to me with an idea and they want to do that in isolation of the community, there's not a lot of deep change or shift that's going to occur, except maybe for that one person. And one of the things that I've really come to believe is that if we truly are a learning community, then we have to behave as a community and not as what I call this sort of like a schoolhouse full of free agents or independent contractors. And so one of the things that I will oftentimes say is when somebody has an idea, I'll say, so who needs to be at the table with you to do this? Who else can you get to invest in being a part of this? You know, and how do you, if you want to label it as something, I would call it, engaging a team. How do you get more than just you into this? And so if that person says, well, yeah, maybe this person or that person, one of the first things I'll say is, well, could we just get, a couple people together or three or four people together and try to put the ideas out and start to shape this up? So that, because one of the things that I know is that when you have a more than one person working on an idea that is an innovative or risk-taking idea, you'll have more opportunity to have people see where you might have blind spots. And so right. One of the things I'll say to people is, when somebody comes to you with something that's a big idea and you go, well, we can't do that, how do you scale that down to something that is within reason that you are willing to trust it to happen? And so, I think about when you see these school systems that have these like big fails, one of the reasons they have big fails is because they don't prototype well. They start out with, the bureaucracy comes up with an idea, they put together a strategic plan, they have all these action steps, they go after it, and then nobody's behind the idea and it just fails.
Right.
But when you start small and you bring in a few people and you let them prototype an idea, that's how a lot of our work has gotten started. Well, that has really spread. It's because one school or three teachers in a school or, you know, a grade level or a department will say, hey, we want to do this. And they'll get together and they'll sort of, it's almost like test bed it. And then they can work the kinks out. So, you know, I haven't, you know, it's not like I've got schools all over the county that are building tree houses, but what message that sent is,
that's right.
If I have an idea, I may have something that's pretty outrageous. And here's one that may sound normative, but was pretty outrageous, was when one of the high school principals 3 years ago, 2 years ago now, I guess, said, you know, I was really thinking, Pam, before I saw most likely to succeed, that what I wanted to do was to put in a ninth grade remediation program for at-risk learners, because, you know, we just really have been working so hard to try to get ninth graders through everything they've got to do to graduate with all the hoops they've got to jump through. But after seeing that, he said, what I really want to do is to put together sort of a team-taught, interdisciplinary approach and, you know, and knock down some walls and you know, just have a very different kind of team-based approach and more project-based, et cetera, you know. And so I said, okay, we can do that. And I said, how long do you want to do that? And he said, well, I'd like to be able to open it in, this was like May. He said, I'd like to be able to open it in August. I was like, okay. But, you know, I mean, he went in, he put together a team, this group of teachers, he picked people that really would get behind this. And this school has got so many different kinds of communities for kids inside it that it's almost as if, you know, it's a comprehensive high school, almost 2,000 kids, that at some point they're going to be at a place where there's going to be almost no kids that are in what you might call a traditional class.
Right.
Because what they keep doing is opening up doors for teachers and kids to figure out something that they want to do together. And it builds these sort of affinity communities. But then what happens is that because of the energy behind it, the teachers start making connections. And so the communities start to interact and engage. So you have this like wild sort of a music construction studio that, you know, is open for kids to come in and they rap and they do all kinds of things. But then they bring in the geeky kids to help them figure out how to build soundproof, you know, booths in there,
right,
for recording. And then, you know, you get the arts kids in there and, you know, and, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, what you see are in most, as you know, most traditional high schools, the boundaries between different groups of kids are so set. But when you get that sort of an open culture of kids working on things that they really love and teachers feeling that they have a sense of power to build out those experiences for kids, and it starts to reinforce who they are as learners themselves, you create this culture in which people are less likely to see themselves in hierarchies or to stake out turf, and more likely to see themselves as almost, if you go back to Thornburg's caves, campfires, and watering holes, that the school becomes this watering hole where, you know, I need this, and I know that this group of kids are really into making, and so I want for my kids in earth science this virtual or augmented or whatever it is, reality way for kids to play with looking at contours. And so you go to the maker kids and they say, oh yeah, sure, we can do that. And then you get the kids talking to each other. And the next thing you know, you've got kids who never would have any experiences with each other,
right,
having those experiences. And it used to be in high schools that those kinds of opportunities for kids to cross-pollinate with each other typically only happened in very specific circumstances. But oftentimes the communities were very much set and separate and very much pecking order communities. I see real changes happening in our high schools as we have gotten to, yes, let people prototype up ideas. This teams-based approach, Jay Thomas, who's fabulous, you know, sort of very open thinking principal. And that's the other thing too, that, you know, you asked me about how do you teach this? I'm not sure you can teach it. I think you can model the process, and that as you model that, one of the things that you do start to notice is that there are people who are better at sort of the creative side of the work, and there are people that are really good at the implementing. And if you can figure out how to have your teams all understanding that if our goal is lifelong learning and our goal is that every kid gets there, then my skill set is in this area and this is how I help contribute to that, that modeling that by building great teams that cross-pollinate really is the way you get there. I don't think you can put people in a classroom and teach it, but I think people, when they see it and they see the results of it, when they see kids walking across a stage who otherwise would have never likely graduated from high school, and they realize this kid's walking across the stage because of something we changed that gave that kid a pathway to learning that didn't exist 15 years ago or even 5 years ago. You know, if you really are in education for the right reasons, you kind of get that. And you start to have a belief system that's less defined by the traditions of education defined in the 20th century and really start to look at, you know, maybe there are kids that we've been missing for a lot of years that have real potential. And it's not about educating everybody for college. It's not about educating everybody to go be a geek or to have some, you know, techie job. It's not about valuing one kind of kid over another. What it's about is building this rich community where kids have pathways to finding, as you know, one of my favorite kids this year that's going to be graduating, Julian Waters, says, you know, oftentimes he says, you know, teachers underestimate the value of informal learning in our schools. And this is a kid who says, schools should be out, the system should be about supporting kids to find their passion. And it doesn't mean that's going to be a lifetime passion, but if it's a passion in the moment, we should be supporting that up. Because every time a kid finds a passion, you know, your life's passions have probably evolved over time. And maybe you have new passions today, Will, that you didn't have 40 years ago.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's okay. You know, and so his belief is that that's what we're about. And he gave the most amazing talk at, he was the only kid that talked at the World Maker Fair last year. And he talked about what he saw change in Albemarle from the time he was in elementary school, the time he's in high school. And this is a kid, and this is just to give you another story, if you can stand another story. But Julian was really into drones. And Julian, you know, had been watching all these YouTube videos about drones and messing around with stuff. But he walked into 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we put a maker space into the library in his high school. And he walked in and discovered, it's like, oh my God, I can make drones in here. And so he starts making drones and bringing some of his stuff in. And, you know, he's kind of the first kid to really get into this. And he's talking to a new principal that came into the school. And he says to Dara, he said, you know, but I feel like I'm kind of, you know, the only kid. And Dara's like, well, why don't you take your drones down to the cafeteria and see if there's some other kids that might be interested. So Julian drags his drones down. And the next thing you know, Julian's got a 30-student drone club in the school, and these kids are like, you know, I'm seeing like Vine videos go up of these kids flying these drones in the gym. They're flying them outside. Then the next thing he gets is he gets a call from the middle school that's right next door. Hey, we've got some kids that are interested. He now has done a startup with the kids over there, you know, and so he's like, you know, and he'll tell you that that wouldn't have happened if he was waiting on a teacher to make that happen. That school now has a group of kids that are involved in a change maker project in which they're building a tiny house. And they started out with the idea of trying to be entrepreneurs to make money off of this and ended up turning it into something that will become a donation back to the community for somebody that's in need of a tiny home. You know, it could be somebody that's homeless or whatever. But that school, you know, I would say that opening up the drone, the makerspace led to that. Then the music studio led to a kid who knew more about the music studio than any teacher in the building, but found a teacher who had, you know, some interest in music. They connected, they co-created a curriculum, and this year the kid is basically co-teaching a class that other kids are getting credit for, that he helped to build the curriculum for it so that kids could learn how to use that music studio and read music and things. And so, you know, I think about that, that's one of the things that's on my mind right now is, you know, you hear a lot today about in some higher education environments, the idea of kids co-creating curriculum and teaching courses that other kids can take so that it's not dependent upon a professor. One of the questions I have is, how do kids become more co-creators of learning in our schools so that it's not something that they see at that learning is dependent upon having an adult in the room?
Right.
How is it that our kids see themselves as capable of building learning experiences for their peers? And it's interesting because that's led to, and Saracen was really, I think, very tuned into the idea that, you know, when I go back in time, I think about multi-age experiences and how we have totally almost filtered multi-age experience out of our schools. But that kids, you know, whether you're thinking about it through a Vygotsky zone of proximal development focus or through, you know, just that sort of peer-to-peer connectivity in communities, that when we have started, when we're putting in a lot more multi-age opportunities at every level, what we see is that when kids have aspirational peers within reach, that they oftentimes will start to see the learning environment as being less about the adult in the room and more about the community being in the space with them.
So one of the things that strikes me always is that what you just said, those stories that you just told, they feel like common sense, right? They feel like that's, why wouldn't we do that? And yet there are a lot of places where they have like a culture of no, and yet kids are still, air quotes, successful in those traditional metrics. They go to college, they, you know, they get good test scores, whatever else, and people seem to be reasonably happy. So I want to end with this question, and that is, so why are the changes that you're doing in Albemarle now, why are they important, not just for you guys, but in a meta sense, why do you think they're important for education writ large right now?
Yeah, well, you know, well, I say to people all the time that I've never defined my sense of mission as being limited to kids that I'm getting paid to have a mission to educate, that I really see mission as an educator. You know, I will say in any group, any time, that educators belong to the most important profession on earth, and that we have an obligation to see ourselves as having a sense of, you know, our voice is important. Our agency is important. Our influence is important. I believe that that is absolutely the essence of what I think about for our kids today, that, you know, I want every kid graduating from high school. In the ideal world, every kid would graduate and say, in Albemarle County Public Schools in Virginia, in the United States of America, I worked with educators who saw my voice as being important, who saw me as a person who could have agency in my own learning and in also influencing my community, small and writ large. We've got a long way to go to get there, but the only way we'll get there is by supporting each other. And, you know, we can't afford to have a society that is as divided by education and opportunity as we have today. You know, probably the area that I'm working on the most right now in terms of trying to realign resources inside Albemarle is around equity and access. And that cuts across everything from infrastructure to quality of the experience that kids get, to the resources that they have in and out of schools, to the community support for kids. And that, you know, that we're living in a time in which this is a turning point. It is a revolutionary time. It is, you know, it's everything from the rise of the global communication network to a time in which, you know, there are a lot of challenges that we have. And those challenges won't get solved through traditional educational means, that we need as many kids and adults growing towards thinking about solutions in every way possible. And, you know, it's as important for the kid who's really into programming to be thinking about how is it that I am going to make life better for people around me as it is for a kid who is, you know, really aspires to be a carpenter or who aspires to be a teacher or who aspires to be, you know, a doctor, whatever it is that kids end up becoming and then, you know, continuing to evolve over time. What's really important is that everybody see themselves as part of the solution finding that we're going to need to move through this next century. And the more disconnected, the more divided, the more that we put people into different categories and labels, the less likely we are to come up with the solutions that will allow us to continue to advance civilization. And civilization, technology advances civilization in some ways. It also impedes civilization in some ways. But what truly advances civilization is the quality of the ideas, the quality of the solutions, the quality of the perspectives that people bring inside communities. And, you know, I think that that's what I'm really after, is having kids grow up to see themselves as being people who, that their voice matters, that their sense of power and control and agency in their own learning matters, that their capability to have influence matters. One of the most poignant things that I saw a kid do recently was one of our elementary kids in a school. We've converted our summer programming to maker spaces. And this was a school that went after a theme of empathy in the summer, so that the kids were thinking about, you know, because a lot of times when you're little and you want to make something, you want to make something for yourself. And so they challenged the kids to find out a problem that somebody else in their life had and find a solution for it. And this kid talked about that his grandmother, this is a funny little tiny problem, but it was a big one for this kid. And this kid worked and worked on this. The grandmother said that because she was on a cane, that she couldn't keep her cell phone with her because she was having to use her hand for her cane that she liked to carry her cell phone in. And so she was always separated from her cell phone. This little kid worked and worked and finally came up with a solution that allowed the grandmother to have this little case that he made that could attach to the cane so that she could carry her cell phone and her cane. But, you know, when the kid talked about it, what really struck me was, you know, he could have come up with some kind of little rocket ship that he would have made that he would have loved to have taken home and maybe, you know, shown to his mom and his dad and, you know, his grandmother and so forth. But we have the potential to support children to see themselves as people who have a sense of empathy. And it is only when we have, as humanity, develop a sense of empathy that we continue to, I think, make our civilization a better space for all of us, not any one of us. And so for me, I think that as an educator, we have not just, it's not just about, yeah, isn't it nice when we help each other out? It's a moral imperative for us as educators to really help each other to grow and develop ourselves and our children as people who first care about other people, and then second, use our learning to help advance ourselves and those around us so that we all get better and become better people.
And I think that's probably a great place to end right there, Pam. So listen, really want to thank you for your time to just chat a little bit about your work in Albemarle. It's an inspiration in a lot of ways, and I'm looking forward to seeing what you come up with next. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Modern Learners Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And don't forget, if you want to continue the conversation, just head on over to our private Modern Learners Facebook group or to modernlearners.com for more information about teaching and learning in a rapidly changing world. We'll see you again next time.